Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix Show, episode 108. I am Johnny Anonymous.
And I'm Dave Rabbit. And what's happening this evening, John and Nader?
Well, besides a yakking to you, I was kind of looking through the newspaper here to see if there were any new movies that I would like to go see. You know, I'm kind of a movie aficionado, but I know that you really are the movie nut. Are there any movies that you're kind of looking forward to checking out here?
Are you talking about for Christmas?
Next millennia, Dave.
Oh, well, Christmas. Let's see. Boy, you caught me off guard, John.
Yeah, I bet believe. I did.
You did. I mean, I wasn't really ready for Christmas. But I'll tell you one I am looking forward to, and it's not coming out until next year, but the new Star Trek movie that is based on the premise kind of Enterprise, the TV series, where everybody is just starting out, and that's when they first meet everybody from the original Star Trek crew. It's got a couple of interesting people that I think is really interesting. One is the guy that's going to play Spock is Zachary Quinto. And for those of you that don't know who Zachary Quinto is, he is the villain Zylar on the TV series Heroes. And, boy, he's already got the eyebrows, John. You know, they may have to tweak those just a tad and put some pointed ears. But, I mean, damn, he looks just like a young Spock. He really does. Perfect casting. And then the other one, I mean, the rest of them are kind of, you know, well, I mean, okay, yeah, I'll buy that, is Simon Pegg, who did Shaun of the Dead and some other British comedy stuff. And he is reprising the role, or playing the role, I guess, of Scotty. So I'm really looking forward to it. I've seen the trailer. Just going to be really, really super. In fact, if you haven't seen the trailer, I'm going to be including a shortcut to the Star Trek movie site that you can check out the trailer and all the other stuff. It's really cool.
Are you a paid Paramount spokesperson or something?
I need to. Well, actually, I'm still trying to get that interview with J.J. Abrams, and this is another J.J. Abrams production. And yeah. I figure if I keep sucking up to J.J. Abrams, the guys in New York are eventually going to get us an interview with this guy.
Are you secretly sending him every show that you do a plug of one of his? Because several weeks back, you were doing Fringe.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the bosses even noticed that. He goes, are you like, are you on their pay list or something?
I wish. No, I can't even. No, my emails are being rejected to the Abrams affiliation people and stuff. So, no.
Well, before we get rejected by the Above Top Secret crew, perhaps we should tell everybody what's on the show. We're going to start off with some UFO sightings.
Oh, great. And then after the UFO sightings, we get back in the groove with the skeptic overlord, a.k.a. Bill Irvin. And we're going to do something a little bit different, start doing something a little bit different, talking about the hot topics and also talking about some of the things from the book Above Top Secret by Jim Mars, and kind of get a little bit more in depth from a paranoia standpoint, I guess.
Sure. And speaking of paranoia,
you don't sound very sincere about that, John.
Yes. We also have a fantastic interview with the sixth man that walked on the moon, Dr. and astronaut Edgar Mitchell.
And man, was that a cool interview, John. I mean, it really was. I learned so much, and I think the members are really going to be excited that we got to ask a lot of member questions from AboveTopSecret.com.
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to do this just for you, because you're such a big Star Trek fan. I'm going to beam us into the next segment, which is the UFO sightings.
Really?
Yeah. Are you ready?
Well, can I ask one question?
No.
Well, I got to ask one question. Just let me ask one question. Will we get put together right? I mean, will our body parts still be in the right place when you do this?
Ask me after we get there.
Uh-oh. Okay. Scary, but okay, John. Let's do it.
This is ATS Mix.
What?
Whoa, whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From above, topsecret.com.
Oh, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
Here are the latest U.S. UFO sightings for AboveTopSecret.com. In Washington, a viewer stated, I was standing at my sliding glass door, which faces southwest, smoking a cigarette, and I happened to look up and see an elongated triangular shape flying due north at a very low level and a very low speed. I would estimate the speed at 30 to 35 miles per hour and the altitude at approximately 150 feet. The craft had a concave on the very front of the thickest part of the elongated triangle, and a strange thing about it was the fact that it was flying with the thick part of the wedge forward and the tip of the triangle aft. I must also note that the sky was gray that evening. The very tip of the aft section of the craft was bending up and down like a pair of diving flippers. I stepped out of the doorway and started to walk down my little walkway that runs alongside of my house to get a closer look at the craft, when the craft itself seemed to notice that I was looking at it, upon which the craft immediately slid sideways on the horizontal towards me without turning left or right and rotating up on its side, where the complete shape of the craft changed. This startled me, and I stopped walking towards the craft, because this black aura started to surround the entire craft like it was angry that I was looking at it. The way the craft looked at this time and how it behaved just blew my mind. It was now a big black circle surrounded by a thin white line with the like a blended thick set of wings with small concaves at the tips of those wings, and the big black circle in the center was blacker than any black I have ever seen. It was emanating an extra black aura all around the circle aimed right at me. When I had stopped walking towards the craft, it had stopped moving towards me. The craft rotated back down as it started to pass by me, and once again the entire shape of the craft changed. It was now like two offset spheres. But the spheres were not completely round because the bottom portion was curved and the rest was a circle. The craft was giving off an aura, and I went to the end of my walkway to the chain link fence so that I could continue to watch the craft for as long as possible as it headed north and went out of sight. This sighting has been on my mind every day since it happened, and it has troubled me ever since. The one thing that I forgot to mention is that this craft was so close to me and it never made a sound. This has been David C.
This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe with sightings from across Canada. About 45 minutes before full sunrise in Edmonton, Alberta, a witness saw from the vantage point of their back window a light brighter than any other star or planet in the morning sky. According to the witness, this bright, steady light had a smooth zigzag to its flight path like the path of a slalom skier. After watching for about 90 seconds, a small flashing was observed significantly further behind and dimmer than the original. Given how fast the light was moving and its apparent altitude, the flash could have been 200 meters behind, giving it the appearance of a flare, but disappearing more quickly. The witness then proceeded to open the back door to listen for any sound, but couldn't identify anything specific, and then moved to the front window to follow its path westward until it was no longer visible. The witness checked the flight path of the International Space Station and discovered it didn't match what was being observed. And a nearby plane was a good comparative point to eliminate the likelihood of this being any known aircraft. The increased daylight made further observation fruitless. 2 days later, at 8:45 p.m. in Kelowna, B.C., five witnesses were out and spotted a yellow-orange glowing object slowly moving through the sky, followed approximately 1 mile behind by two more yellow-orange glowing objects. After about 5 minutes, the two trailing lights caught up with the original glowing ball at 1/2 mile apart each. The witnesses continued observing 5 more minutes as the objects appeared to ascend and disappear. This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe, keeping my eyes to the skies for AboveTopSecret.com.
And now it's time for a different view. This is the Skeptic Overview.
Well, it's time once again, now that we've kind of gotten back onto our regular schedule, to bring back the one, the only Skeptic Overlord. Yes. Yeah. How you doing there, Bill?
Well, okay. Well, thanks for finally having me back, giving me the shoulder for a couple of weeks here.
Yeah, we put you on the back burner
Busy for all these other, like, you know, best-selling authors.
Yeah, and, you know. Well, I will say this. I thought Jim Mars' two-part interview was absolutely phenomenal. Every UTU that we've gotten and every comment we've gotten has just been nothing but thumbs up, and especially those that have gotten the book. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's killer. It's killer. Well, what we're going to do for the next few skeptic overviews is, in a way, while we're, you know, going to cover the popular topics, we'll also, you know, cover most of the topics covered in the book, not so much in what Jim writes about them, which we will touch on from time to time, but also what's on ATS, which was literally the source material for right. what Jim was writing about in the book. So I think that'd be an interesting way to continue to talk about the book, what's in it, and get the members interested and our listeners in really understanding the uniqueness of this book, that it is certainly, you know, great author Jim Myers wrote this, but it is based on great material that our members have been contributing for the past several years. And that's what makes this book very different than any other conspiracy books out there, that it's written in sort of a journalistic style and inspired by Above Top Secret. And then Jim, as Jim always does, takes everything further.
Cool.
Well, anyway, if our listeners want to really catch up, and I know we mentioned this page once before, and I think we should just start using this page right. as a jumping off point for right. more what we talk about on the overview. If you go to AboveTopSecret.com, and right up at the top, there's a button that says This Week. You click on that, and you can see the most popular and most important topics for the past 7 days on ATS. And it's always a really interesting summary. It's actually sometimes a much, for people that aren't familiar with discussion boards, this is a much easier place to land on to get a sense for what are the currently the most popular, the most talked about, and the most important topics, of course, by flags or member flags. Our members flag the topics. The more flags, apparently, the more important it is to our membership.
Right.
And you, with this, you can get a really good snapshot of what's been important over the past 7 days. And right at the top is what's been happening in India, the terror attacks. Just an incredible thing that happened last week. What is it, like... Six days ago now that really started.
Yeah.
I mean, the timing, I mean, it's terrible. It's tragic. I mean, there's an incredible loss of life. And, you know, we certainly know in this country what that's like. And those of us who were unfortunate enough to be in New York City during 9/11 have a bit more of a firsthand perspective on that. We saw on sites like Above Top Secret, and we weren't the only one that started to examine this angle, is the... you know, sort of the convenient circumstances around this terror attack that start to feel like the same convenient circumstances of things like 9/11 and the bombings in Madrid and in London, where, you know, there was a weird buildup of activity. We remember the U.S. was sending their drones into Pakistan, bombing some terror camps there, and putting pressure on Pakistan, and in turn, then putting pressure back on us. And then, oh, suddenly there's an attack in India. And a lot of the conspiracy discussion on ATS, four of those types of threads, are right on this page. Some of it containing reports where people have seen Caucasians in with the terrorists. Several reports, I should say. It's not just one, and one was actually covered by the BBC, where the Mumbai attacks were... The attackers had Anglo-Americans, what appeared to be Anglo-Americans, mixed in with the groups. So that was interesting, and then that sparks a lot of conspiracy speculation. It certainly is profitable for the United States to continue to push the war on terror, and this would be one way to keep that push going, is for us to be called in to help other countries that have a problem with terrorism.
I can foresee, and you guys jump in if you disagree with me, but I can foresee, and please everybody understand, this is a terrible tragedy, but I can see from a terrorist standpoint that they would consider this to be a very successful terrorist incursion. And what scares me is we're sitting in a restaurant out in Dallas where we live, and I said to Bunny, I said, you know, I can see a bunch of nuts, especially in a country like the United States that has all the hardly any gun laws to speak of. You know, I can see a bunch of people, you know, in two-man teams in states throughout the United States doing this same thing. And I can tell you that that would cause utter chaos if that were to happen.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the media, I mean, that would be a frenzy in the media.
Oh.
People would be just terrified to leave their homes. And on the other hand, it would also cause a frenzy of what's the best way to put it? Eager militia out looking for the terrorists.
Racial profiling would be skyrocketing, okay. Would it not?
Yeah, we'd have. I mean, the amount of guns in this country, as you mentioned, would also spark a response from the people with guns.
Right.
If law enforcement isn't able to provide a response effective enough in those people's opinions. So
yeah, you're talking about an old West shootout scenario. I mean, you know, that's exactly what you'd have. I mean, you'd have people packing guns with or without a permit just to you know, to protect their family.
Sure.
Scary. God, that's scary.
Which is a scenario that's been mentioned in another article and an interesting thread linked from this page is the Citigroup memo that came out this week, concerned that there could essentially be, in 2 years, if the economic crisis continues to get worse, essentially lawlessness in major countries like the United States because the economic condition gets so bad.
Right.
And this is another thing that came up this week where major international financial organizations have – they always try to prognosticate and prepare, just so that they can remain an organization to prepare for the worst or the best and have contingency plans just like a government would. So I'm sure that they've been for years having plans on the shelves for what the corporation would do in the event of certain circumstances, and you know, it came out that they had plans in the event that the financial crisis caused lawlessness in major countries.
And speaking of that topic, several associates and friends of mine happen to work at some gun stores where they sell weapons, and they have told me that in about the past month and a half to 2 months' time, there has been an outrageous amount of purchases for ammunition, so much so that they can hardly keep it on the shelves.
Wow.
And I don't understand that, yeah, unless they fear that perhaps the economic situation might get to the point, as you were pointing out.
Right. Well, I think whenever the times are incredibly uncertain, and this is how it was in the 70s, too, when we had the oil crisis and things were really bleak in the Iran hostage situation, rather. I mean, things were pretty bleak back then, and there was a lot of concern that they could get real bad. A lot of people were looking to have handguns and other things on hand in the event things got in the event the feces hit the fan, so to speak.
Right.
So that's been another topic that's been really popular this past week. And then of course the inevitable Black Friday, somebody gets trampled and killed in a store. I mean, how many times do I have to go through that?
And I'm not laughing because of the person that got killed, but I mean, come on, you know?
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's crazy.
At a Walmart, no less, right?
It's always at a Walmart, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they got the best prices, let's face it, you know? I mean, their stock's up.
Is it really that important to get to $10 off the toaster? That you got to storm the store, break the doors, and trample over the guy just trying to keep order.
Is there going to be a test on this later?
Well, it doesn't involve reading. So
okay, good. All right. If it's verbal skills, I'm in good shape then.
So what else is going on in the world that's got you kind of taking a gander at here, Bill?
Well, there's a whole bunch of topics here, and it changes on an almost hourly basis. This page is refreshed every 2 hours, so it gives you a chance to really see a live and updated version of what's going on. And I can tell you right now that there's, I think, a total of 120 topics on the page that are covered, and the least replied topic has 73 replies. So even that is a very active topic. I mean, we still have more discussion and speculation going on about Obama's birth certificate. That seems to – I don't know if that's ever going to die. I mean, that could be that could be the ongoing conspiracy of the Obama
So you're saying that could be his Monica Lewinsky?
You know, it's
– If it's got a blue dress.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call it Monica Lewinsky, but
no, I
know.
It's
going to be there in the background for a long, long time. And so we have vanishing sunspots. You know, scientists are worried that it's signaling the beginning of another ice age. So, yeah, we've got lots of bad news.
Well, yeah. Hey, listen, you know, some of the things that we really want to talk about are the book itself, Above Top Secret. And
right. Every chapter in the book has a companion page on Above Top Secret. And each time you go to a chapter, there will be a little who, what, when, where, why summary. And then at the bottom of that is a URL for a page you can go to that will give you not just the threads that Jim used in his research, but also everything new that's happening on that particular topic.
Right.
So it turns the book into almost a user guide, if you will, for all of these conspiracies that Jim covers, 19 different conspiracies and topics on ATS. And you don't really need the book to find those pages. You can just go to abovetopsecret.com/book. Ha!
That's simple.
The secret code there.
I love that.
And then you'll see this foreword written by some nut job.
Yeah, who is this guy? Who is that guy?
He's just long-winded is what he is.
Yeah, he really is.
Men in tights! Well, superhuman tights, at least.
Right. To the right, though, you'll see a picture of the book, and below that are links to all of the chapters.
Who's Bill Irvine?
You know, like I said, he's some long-winded guy who just likes to type on. He's really pompous.
Is that famous Bill Irvine that didn't quite make it on Dancing with the Stars?
Man, are you cruising for a bruising, Dave?
I know, I really am, aren't I?
No, they told him, oh, you know, you're too good. We need somebody that's going to be improving for week to week.
So sorry. I heard you do a mean tango.
By the way,
there.
If you'd like to send those applications for a partnership in the new ATS Mix show, starring Johnny Anonymous and possibly you.
Johnny Anonymous and you.
That's right.
Sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
What would be a cool name is Johnny Anonymous and Mr. Nobody. Well, that has a certain ring to it.
Yeah, that does have a ring to it. Yeah. All right. Anyway, sorry. I'll just be quiet. Go ahead.
Anyway, to the right is like I said before I was interrupted by somebody who's just not paying attention at all. A link of chapters that will take you to the summary pages for all of the different topics. The first one that Jim covers in the book was 9/11, an inside job. And when you click through to that page, again, it's very obvious, abovetopsecret.com/book/9/11. And what it does is it covers about 9 or 10, gives you links and summaries to 9 or 10 threads that are recent. And in this case, when we say recent, within the past 3 months that became popular discussion topics.
Right.
Then the page goes down and then you'll get a list of some of the most popular topics of all time. And the one in this case is the old thread from 2004 by Cat Herder. 9/11, a Boeing 757 did indeed strike the Pentagon with 5,606 replies. It just got another reply yesterday. It's the thread that lives on forever.
Was it anonymous?
Wow. No, it wasn't anonymous. That thread has actually very few anonymous replies, which is very interesting. All of these threads that have risen in popularity and have a high number of flags are incredible. As we go down the list, I mean, you're still covering 110 total topics with summaries on this page, and then there's even a longer list to the right. The least replied topic on the page has 215 topics, or replies, I should say. So it's a pretty good summary of all the stuff that's being talked about, and members can go there. And you know, we've talked about 9/11 a lot on the show. You have Willie Rodriguez on there and a few other people talking about it. We've talked about it in the overviews. I don't think we need to get into it too much. But the interesting thing that I really liked about the way Jim wrote the book is he took a real journalistic approach where rather than trying to come to conclusions himself, is he took what's being the more popular angles discussed on ATS, covered those, did a little bit more research on his own based on those topics, brought a little bit more information into the book, and just gave to you a really good collection of all the better conspiracy discussions happening around 9/11. And like we said earlier, some of these things, every time there's a conspiracy, there's some angles that are plausible, some that are just plain silly, and some that are interesting. And I think he's got a good mix of the plausible, while still showing some of the really speculative ones that that are out there that could still be something with a little bit more research. But on this page, you'll find everything from the speculation, which you know has interesting research and evidence, where one theory is saying that there was a hydrogen bomb inside the building, and if you follow the research, there is indeed a theoretical method to have a shaped nuclear explosion. And while that thought might initially cause you to go, oh, how silly is that, a hydrogen bomb in lower Manhattan? Well, it turns out that the science does exist to create a shape charge that would have obliterated the cores of those buildings and then allow them to come down rather quickly. So, well, on the one hand, that theory may seem silly just by the headline. When you read through the thread, you realize, well, there's actually some science behind the speculation of that particular part of the 9/11 conspiracies. Right. And then there's a few threads here with Jesse Ventura and Rosie O'Donnell, and some that are really excellent threads more from a skeptical standpoint, where it's a great discussion. While the title of this thread, 9/11 Conspiracies Are Nonsense, might cause the conspiracy theorist to have a knee-jerk, angry reaction, it actually turned into a pretty good discussion back and forth between about four or five different people that are really passionate about finding the truth about the conspiracies, and then others that are really passionate about, you know, trying to disprove the conspiracies. And it was reasonably well-behaved, so that was another good discussion to see the different sides playing against each other.
Just a quick insert here. I wanted to give a quick shout-out to Zeissen5 because he gives Johnny and I a yell-out and talks about our interview with Willie Rodriguez. So, hey, Zeissen5, thanks a lot, brother. Appreciate the shout-out. Okay, Bill, sorry. Go ahead.
It's publicity whoredom at its best.
Trailers for sale.
Sorry.
So sorry, Bill.
You never met a plug you didn't like, did you?
Oh, ouch!
You know, the plug fits where it, you know?
It all works in the end.
Oh. Waka waka.
Waka waka.
Bill has no...
Anyway, to close out this topic, I am
Thank
tossing
God. All right.
I am tossing a question out for you two guys.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, right?
Where's my pencil?
Yeah, one of the threads that's current, it's... from October of 2008, and has 145 replies. It's titled 9/11 Truth Fading Away. And the author goes into, and it's by Throat Yogurt again. So he's got a couple of pretty good 9/11 topics showing, actually quite a few, four 9/11 topics showing up on this page now.
Right.
At the top. And he says that after reading through threads in ATS and different forums and doing a little research on the traffic that a lot of the 9/11 sites are getting, he does come to the conclusion that possibly the whole movement is fading away. And we have certainly seen, if you will, the noise of 9/11 sort of die down in ATS over the past 2 years. Now, what do you guys think? Do you think it's fading away, or do you think that the Looney Tunes that just went totally nuts over just absolutely crazy theories have just given up and moved on to something else?
I blame fluoride in the water. you know, just as they used that in the concentration camps to keep the prisoners passive, I think the more fluoride in the water keeps us a little bit more dumb. No, besides that,
plagiarism.
Besides that being probably an actuality. To answer your question, you know what? I think you may be kind of onto something about the noise bit. I think that there has been so much noise that even the people that are so passionate about it, one one of the things that I noticed all through their passion and wanting to get to the truth is that none of them could seem to get on board the same camp. You know, it was almost like, you got to go visit us over here because we've got the 9/11 truth. No, no, you need to go over here to this camp. And there was so much bickering, in my opinion, going on amongst all the ones that were trying to get the truth out that I think a lot of people just said, started throwing up their hands and going, wow, if you guys can't get along with yourselves, how on earth are we supposed to try to come together to find the truth? At least that's, yeah, that's just one idea.
You had 10 different groups, all of them going 1,000 different directions, and over a period of time, I think people just got worn out with it. I mean, my Lord, you don't see that many people that are as passionate about the JFK assassination as they were even 5 years ago, you know? And I think it is, Bill, to answer your question, a very diminished conspiracy road that a lot of these are on because they've just got tired of butting heads with each other.
Okay, okay. So this is where I was going to go anyway with this comment, and it's wonderful that you two set this up.
Uh-oh.
Now, hang with me for a bit here. What you've set up is essentially, yeah, I mean, the noise, the if you will, and for a long time there's just incredible bickering amongst the different camps. Also, all the different camps seem to be trying to create the most preposterous conspiracy theories to draw attention to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if there was a one-upmanship going on.
Exactly.
And that was happening for quite some time. And it seems as though clearly in the past 18 months and definitely in the past year, that's fading. And wait a second. So is the Bush administration.
So there's a correlation, you think?
Yes. Now, hold on here, Davey boy. If you remember, soon after the attack, rewind your brain and try to remember to Bush's speech days after the attack saying, don't pay attention to those conspiracy theories.
Ah, yeah, right.
And
yeah,
that's right.
There was an explosion of conspiracy theories. One of the early conspiracy theories out there in relation to the entire event was that there was a group somewhere deep in some government agency creating many of these most outrageous conspiracy theories specifically to create so much incredible noise on the internet that it would be impossible for amateur conspiracy theorists out there to find the truth on their own. Create so much noise that the truth is in there buried somewhere, but there's just so much other stuff that it's impossible to really collaboratively come to the truth. And now that the administration that was in charge as this event happened is fading, isn't it odd that so is the cacophony, the incredible noise of conspiracy theories is also fading?
Wow. That's pretty deep.
So wow.
You bet your buttocks.
Yeah.
Doesn't it chap your buttocks?
I never thought of that. That has never, ever entered my mind until you just said that.
Yeah, me either.
You heard it here first, folks.
I love that. All right, well, what about peak oil?
Moving on to the next topic.
Nice segue, Dave.
Thanks.
Jeez.
The next topic that Jim covers is the concept of peak oil. And just as Dave says, what about peak oil? And really, what do you guys think? Jim writes in his book, you know, he substantiates the research, that for every 8 barrels of oil we use, we only find one more in the earth. So clearly, it's going to stop at some point.
Sure.
All right, shall I start this time, John?
Oh, my God, please.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'll tell you what I got to thinking about the other day, and I don't know. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's because I'm not sitting there with, you know, nine wives and, you know, banging camels and stuff over there in Saudi Arabia. But here's the deal. You know,
what? Holy mackerel. Okay. Jeez.
Wait up, man.
Where's my decryptic ring? All right, go ahead.
I'm going to tell you where I'm going with this. I mean, hang on.
Hope he goes
all right,
somewhere.
Now, here's the thing that chaps my buttocks, and that is, here's all these guys over there with their 24-carat toilet seats and all this other crap over there, and they're sitting there having this big meeting, going to decide how they want to get the economic situation, you know, settled down, and let's try to arrive at $75 a barrel or whatever. Johnny and I were talking about this the other day, just on one of our daily chats that we have with each other just to see if we're still alive. Clear! Anyway, so what happens is, you know, these guys are sitting there trying to figure out, you know, okay, well, let's land on $75. But here's my thoughts. You know, if these guys were smart, Bill and John, if these guys were smart, to me, I think I would try to make it as cheap as possible to where all these people that are scrambling for alternative energy would maybe slow their pace down a bit, going, oh, well, gas is back down to $1.25, you know. There's no sense in rushing out and getting the wind turbines and getting all the solar energy and whatever. To me, these ass wipes are doing it the wrong way. You know, they're sitting there trying to maximize their profit but still not putting the entire world economy down the toilet. But I still think they're approaching it the wrong way because they keep it at 75, 80, 85. Well, John said the other day, well, as long as it's under $2, well, hell, you know, $2 a gallon gasoline, John, I mean, this, and I'm not debating with you, but $2 a gallon gas is still going to affect millions of people in the United States and around the world. So to me, their smart play would be to make it so cheap that people wouldn't panic, and then they have them right back by the gonads again. That's just my thoughts.
Well, Senor Rabbit, you kind of misconstrued some of my thoughts there. But one of the things that I think is interesting is that during all the start of the economic crisis, which we've been seeing continually snowball here for quite a while, actually, we were seeing record profits by the petroleum industry, and the price of oil just kept going up and up and up and up, and they were still quoting record profits every quarter. My thought is, yes, when you see the price of oil and gas, let's just take gas since we're talking about the standard John and Jane Doe scenario here. When gas gets to a point where it is so much lower than it was, say, last year, where it was over $4 or in some places per gallon, and now is under $2 a gallon, yes, there will probably definitely be those that were so passionate about alternative energy that they perhaps now don't pay as much attention to moving forward in the search for alternative energy, even though maybe in the back of their mind, they are not realizing that bell curve wise, we are, as Bill said, you know, we are going to run out of oil. It's going to be in a very short while. But because the price of gas, it's part of that dumbing of America, you know, oh, as long as I don't have to pay so much at the pump, they're not going to think about as much in the alternative energy department as they would if it was still floating at $4. Now, the other thing is, I find it extremely interesting that now here again, as Bill pointed out in that other little scenario that I hadn't even thought of concept-wise with the Bush administration getting ready to leave, part of the drop in the price is to kind of mellow out the crowd a little bit, you know, to kind of sucker them back into the dumbing of America. Oh, you know, don't pay attention to what's going on over here because, hey, look, your price of gas is under $2 now.
So, right, that's what I was saying. Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying.
Well, a big factor in the drop in price is the drop in demand because of the economic downturn. There's not as much manufacturing, not as much transportation of goods going on. So there's not as much demand. You know, people aren't driving to vacations as much. So the overall demand for petroleum products has decreased, which in turn is causing the lower price. Now, that's not the only thing. Certainly, there's some manipulation going on of these world events. And touching, you know, sort of combining all the thoughts together, we have some natural market-based decrease in the price of oil because of the lowering of demand. But then again, this incredible financial crisis is also timed at precisely the moment in history when alternative energy, when it's most critical for investments in the development of alternative energies, not just because we're running out of oil, but because there's also a lot of concern that fossil fuels are really screwing up the atmosphere and causing some issues. Now, whether or not the fossil fuels are causing global warming, that's always going to be an incredibly hot point for debate. But we do know that it is a contributing factor to the situation we have now, where the Earth is warmer and the fossil fuels are making it worse. So there's that concern. But now that we have this financial crisis, it's going to be difficult to invest in the alternative energy technology that we need to. So there's sort of this, you know, confluence of things all happening at once, a perfect storm of crap going on. And 5 years from now, who knows what it's going to be like once we come out the other end of this storm.
When the Carter administration was in full bloom, and wasn't there kind of a similar situation where the administration basically told OPEC, hey, look, if you don't lower the price, we're going to really start pursuing alternative energy? Was that around that administration time?
Yeah, but Carter said it. I mean, who took him serious? I mean, yeah, Carter said, I mean, we weren't getting any oil from OPEC, which is what caused the crisis, and there was a lot of back and forth, nasty words being said. And in the end, it was a devil's deal that got us back into the good graces of the Saudis and receiving their oil. And sure, I mean, you know, we're paying the dividends to this day. I mean, they're laughing all the way to the bank. The Saudis have made money from us on the oil. They own major portions of our banks, and now we're bailing out the financial system, and they're reaping the rewards from that too. So I mean, how many different ways are they making money off of us now? So you see, you got the oil, you got the financial system, you got the bailout. I mean, you know, how many ways you're going to lose fingers trying to count?
Is that like that that song, 50 Ways to Lose Your Lover or something?
Sure, that's like that song.
Okay, good.
Nice tie-in, Dave.
Yeah,
I couldn't come up with something any better than that. I was trying to think of a song, you know.
What got me is in the very beginning when you were talking about peak oil and it chapping your hide, and I was thinking, well, how is that possible? Sorry.
No, well, I can tell you. See, now, you guys, you just start laughing. You know, I can tell you exactly how. That's when it chapped your hide.
Here we go.
All right.
If there's no petroleum, there's no petroleum jelly.
There you go. And therefore, no KY jelly, which is a derivative of oil, right?
That will indeed chap your hide.
Well, we all hope it all works out in the end for you, Dave.
Ooh!
Yeah, a joke's so nice you can use it twice.
Yes, I love that.
Well, I got to tell you that it's...
Bill and Johnny will be here all night, folks.
This has been a fairly a most pleasant and enjoyable time getting us back onto the regular schedule here where we bring back this skeptic overview. I think it's going to be one for the books.
It's going to be one for something. We'll find out what kind of book later.
We're going to end the Skeptic Overlord show on that point. And on behalf of Johnny and Dave and... The Skeptic Overlord. We'll see you next time on The Skeptic Overview.
All right. Good night, kids. Have fun.
Oh, I love that part. See?
Bye, Bill.
All right, Bill.
It's the same dream night after night. I hear this beating, this rhythm. I'm wandering like an unfulfilled lost soul through this misty haze. But I keep following the sound. It seems like I walk forever. In the distance, I see something beautiful. Magnificent. It seems so far away, yet so near that I could reach out and touch it. As I approach closer, I can see millions of people, all ages, races, religions, philosophies. People from around the world and from every nation on terrestrial Earth. They're moving in mass towards something mystical, magical, magnetic. As I follow them, all of a sudden they begin to create a path for me to walk through. I can see something massive on the horizon. As I get closer, I see a banner unfurling in the gentle wind. It says, "Welcome to the revolution." The crowd begins cheering and celebrating. I'm so overwhelmed by the experience that I wake, still hearing the beating of the heart. And then my dream becomes crystal clear. I have found my holy grail. My thirst is quenched. My lifelong quest finally achieved. I have found AboveTopSecret.com. And my beating heart joins theirs. I have become a member. Welcome to our revolution.
ATS Mix.
We're rolling.
ATS Mix featured interview.
Well, it's going to be another red letter day for the ATS Mix here, Dave. Are you all ready for this?
I really am. And I tell you, ever since we first found out that we were going to have an opportunity to interview our guest, I tell you, John, I have always admired and loved those men that have the right stuff. And boy, what a real thrill it's going to be today for me.
Well, speaking of the right stuff, let's go ahead and tell our listeners who we have as our very special exclusive guest on the ATS Mix. He's a scientist, test pilot, naval officer, astronaut, entrepreneur, author, and lecturer. Dr. Mitchell's extraordinary career personifies humankind's external thrust to widen its horizons as well as its inner soul. On January 31st, 1971, Navy Captain Dr. Edgar Mitchell embarked on a journey into outer space that resulted in becoming the sixth man to walk on the moon. The Apollo 14 mission was NASA's third manned lunar landing. This historic journey ended safely 9 days later on February 9th, 1971. His academic background includes a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Management from Carnegie Mellon University, a Bachelor of Science from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and a Doctorate of Science in Aeronautics and Astronautics from MIT. In addition, he has received honorary doctorates in engineering from New Mexico State University, the University of Akron, and Carnegie Mellon University. Dr. Mitchell has received many and numerous awards and honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the USN Distinguished Medal, and 3 NASA Group Achievement Awards. He was inducted to the Space Hall of Fame in 1979 and the Astronaut Hall of Fame in 1998. After retiring from the Navy in 1972, Dr. Mitchell founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences to sponsor research into the nature of consciousness as it relates to cosmology. In 1984, he was the co-founder of the Association of Space Explorers, an international organization of those who experienced space travel. He is also the author of several books, including The Psychic Exploration and The Way of the Explorer. Dr. Mitchell has spent the last 30 years studying human consciousness and psychic and paranormal phenomena in the search for a common ground between science and spirit. The ATS Mix and Dave and Johnny especially are very honored to have with us today Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. A little bit long, I'll have to admit. But it was fine.
A gentleman who has achieved as much as you have, we tried to summarize as much as we could, and it was still that lengthy.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
Well, Edgar, this is Dave, and I again want to tell you how thankful that Johnny and I are, and as well as the all the members and the owners and all the people that are connected with AboveTopSecret.com for allowing us to have about 45 minutes with you today. But you know, the thing that I find most amazing, Edgar, about your long list of things is the amount of awards that you've achieved over your span of time. What is the one award, Edgar, that you're most proud of, do you think?
Well, I think I have to be totally honest, which I will be. The one you didn't mention.
Oh.
Was I was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. And I didn't find it on the list, I think, that you probably picked up.
What were you submitted for, Dr. Mitchell?
Primarily for the work I've done in noetics with my foundation in doing research into the nature of consciousness and trying to improve the human condition with our understanding of the new sciences.
Speaking of that, let's go ahead and of course, we will include all the information and all the shortcuts to all your sites, but let's go ahead and mention the sites that you have, and you have 3, and I have them up right now, that are just absolutely amazing. The first one is at edmitchellapollo14.com. The second one is, as you've just spoken about, is noetic, noetic.org. And then the third one is Quantrek, which is Quantrek.org. Can you tell me just a little bit about these 3 websites and how they came about? Let's start with your Apollo14.com website first.
Well, that, of course, is my personal website, which I offer on there my books and photographs for the collectors that want those, and DVDs and CDs that relate to my work and to spaceflight. Then the the noetic one is one related to the research organization in California that I founded in order to pursue work in consciousness studies from the point of view of science. And then the Quantric one is a similar one, except it's rooted in the very hard science in physics and some of the new work that's just been discovered in the last few years. And so it's a little more toward the hard sciences than noetics is.
Would you tell our listeners just a little bit about what motivated you to write your two books?
Well, first of all, back 40 years ago, as I was just studying this and that, studying philosophy, and after I had my PhD, I was a pretty studious sort of guy, and I became interested in the work of Dr. J.B. Rhine at Duke University, and his work was in parapsychology, we called it at that time. I really don't like the word para because it's not the correct word, and I became interested in that, and I looked at much of the work, and I said, if this is real, then we in science are derelict in not pursuing this, because this is really fundamental to, this is very fundamental to just almost everything that we should be really interested in. So I started pursuing it more, and then I eventually, as perhaps you're aware, did a very private experiment on the way to the moon and back, emulating the sort of thing that Ryan had done in the laboratory with his experimental work. And we got about the same results as he did. I mean, as a matter of fact, he did all the checking of the of our data. He and another independent scientist. And lo and behold, we didn't got as good results as they could get in the laboratory. But we were 200,000 miles away from Earth. So that was kind of significant. So anyhow, that's a part of the work I've been doing. That's, I think, considered quite important and fascinating. And then my other, then on the way back from the moon, I had a very powerful experience in which I suddenly recognized from my studies in astronomy at Harvard and MIT when I do my doctoral work, I had an experience in which I recognized that the molecules of my body and the molecules in the spacecraft and my partner's bodies were created or prototyped at least in some ancient generation of stars. Which is now, I mean, that's common knowledge for anyone that studied cosmology and anyone that studied star systems and astronomy.
Right.
But then it was still not, you know, so widely, such widely spread ideas. And it was suddenly my recognition that my molecules, and not as intellectual knowledge, but at a visceral level, that my molecules were created in those star systems, or at least prototyped in those star systems. And everything was interconnected. Well, the great mystics of all times have been telling us that for centuries, but suddenly we haven't had anything in science to tell us that, except this brand new discipline of the 20th century called quantum physics. And all of a sudden, here we had I had an experience that tied that in very, very directly to modern studies, and was kind of the basis after I got back for starting my Noetic Foundation to pursue the nature of consciousness as a science subject in science, because that's been a no-no for 400 years.
Right.
The times of Newton and Descartes, when René Descartes got the Inquisition off the backs of the intellectuals of the period by making the pronouncement that body, mind, and physicality were two different realms of reality that didn't interact. And so we've believed that for 400 years. But quantum science in the early 20th century shows that not to be true. So here we had some whole new things to look at, and particularly since I was in space and realized that humans forever, since we looked up into the stars and wondered, who are we, how did we get here, what's it really all about that we're in, that maybe now that we were spacefarers, and I was fortunate enough to be on the first generation of spacefarers to go out away from our planet and go to another planet, that maybe we ought to rethink all of these ancient questions from the new perspective, because maybe some of our older ideas were not complete and perhaps flawed. So that's been what I've done for the last 35 years.
Wow.
You know, Dr. Mitchell, I want to ask you this. Here in the past several years, you've been publicly noticed as coming out in saying that you believe that, excuse me, that life exists outside of our earthly realm. I'm just kind of curious, do you happen to recall when you came to the realization that, you know, it's time for me to go public with this? Was there a particular date or an event scenario that happened that made you decide?
It kind of grew, frankly. I guess I had the vague awareness from the time I really started studying astronomy, vague awareness, and starting looking at some of the powerful pictures of our universe from our telescopes. But most particularly, after we started getting photographs from the Hubble Space Telescope, which many people can see today, and looking at the magnificence and the size and the complexity of this universe we're in, far beyond anything our ancestors, even 50 years ago, could look at, it became pretty obvious that, there's no way we could be alone in the universe with all of that. But to think otherwise was just really not recognizing the complexity of everything that we're in. Now, that was built upon the fact that I grew up in Roswell, New Mexico, where the site of the so-called first acknowledged, or not really acknowledged, but denied site, crash of a alien spacecraft. So once all of that came together, there was just no way to not acknowledge that anymore. It was a growing realization, not a moment, as you were suggesting.
Yeah, well, the only reason why I brought that up is I had an anonymous source send me some information here about, I guess, some event that you may have been involved with back in, let's see, was it 94 or 95, where apparently you and a group of other people got together in a coalition that I believe was called Project Starlight. Does that ring any bells?
I know of that, but I don't. You'll have to remind me. I don't believe I was physically present. But go ahead and describe it, and I'll correct myself if I'm wrong.
Okay, well,
I remember that, but I don't remember physically being present at that.
Sure. Some of the people that were there, and I believe this was at Pacific Grove, and
I
can't.
California. Okay.
Yeah. And
I've been there quite a few times.
Right. Some of the other people that were supposedly there with you was George Lamb, Kevin Foley, Sandy Wright, Brian O'Leary, Colonel Jesse Marcel, and a variety of others.
Okay, I'm with you. I'd almost forgotten that one, but you're right, I was there.
Well, it was purported that may have been a kind of a landmark time where you actually decided to perhaps go public with some of this information.
Well, perhaps, but it really just built on the previous experience that had been building for a number of years. That's right.
All right. Well, before we get into the member questions, Edgar, you know, I try to ask this of everybody that has been ex-military. I did 3 tours in Vietnam. I know that you got out of the Navy in 71. I was in the Air Force from 67 to 71. So I guess my question is, as a naval aviator, did you ever fly any missions in Southeast Asia?
No. My military time, active duty Navy time, was with the Korean War, long before. I was already in the astronaut program by the Vietnam War.
Okay.
I was still a military officer, but my active duty time was in 1952 through in the Navy, 52 through 58, when I was on duty, and I became a Navy test pilot. But the really interesting thing is that I was on my way back from duty in the Pacific aboard an aircraft carrier in 1957, on October the 4th specifically. Coming back to test pilot duty when Sputnik went up, and that kind of changed my life.
Wow.
And my direction right then.
Wow.
And so I more was oriented from that point on toward astronauts. Really hadn't been selected,
right?
But I realized that humans would be right behind robot spacecraft, since Sputnik was the first one up, and that in due course we would be. And so that started changing my direction at that point to be ready to go into space at a moment's notice. It took me 9 more years to get my education that I wanted and to serve as a test pilot and then to be selected from Edwards Air Force Base at the test pilot school into the Apollo program in 1966.
Okay, now that I have one quick follow-up, and then I'm going to toss it to the Johninator to ask him some of the questions. Do you remember the day that you were physically knew that you were accepted into the space program and may have an opportunity to actually leave planet Earth? Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. I was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base in California, and the test pilot school worked for the fabulous Chuck Yeager at that point.
Wow.
And I was both a student and an instructor. I was getting, at that point, to go through the space program, rather the space portion of the test pilot school, which meant fly some rocket planes and a few things like that. But I was also teaching optimization theory to some of the budding astronauts that had come in through the so-called manned orbiting laboratory program, which was the military space program. Anyhow, and yes, I still lived in Los Angeles. My family did, and I commuted out to Edwards Air Force Base during the week. And I was at home one night, at home with my family on this particular night, and got a phone call from Deke Slayton, who was head of the astronaut office at that point in time. And he said, Commander Mitchell, we think we would like for you to join us here in Houston. Do you think you might like to do that? And I said, let me think about it. Yes, sir, I certainly would. I thought about it maybe for a millisecond.
And you mentioned Deke because he's portrayed in, you know, The Right Stuff as well as Chuck Yeager and stuff. So, wow, I mean, this had to have been just something that was your dream, was it not?
Well, it seemed my career from that point, from even the earliest days, seemed to be an awful lot, very much like a dream. That is quite true.
Hmm.
Hard to really understand that things were just happening that way.
Right. We have a number of listeners that have posted questions for you, Dr. Mitchell, and so at this time we would like to ask some of these questions as Dave and I will act as the mediator posing their questions to you. Some of them may seem rather discombobulated, and we will apologize for that as we try to query them just as they posted them. So these first two questions, I'm actually going to combine because they're both along the same nature, and one is by a listener that goes by the moniker Seagull, and the other one is by the moniker JPM1602. And since most of their questions are similar, I thought I would just combine the two. Dr. Mitchell, first I have to offer my most profound respect to you and the other Apollo astronauts. Now that that's out of the way, you spoke of a sense of universal connectedness. Could you possibly expound upon that a bit more? And the other member asked that he also was very fascinated with your spiritual experience, being one with the universe, and he wanted to know what that experience might be like. So we have two questions there that are kind of connected, so I'll let you address them.
Okay, I'll set this up very briefly, quickly. It was on the way home. I touched upon it earlier. It was on the way home after the hard work on the surface was done, and we were oriented such that, and rotating to keep thermal balance on the spacecraft, oriented such that every 2 minutes a picture of the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a 360-degree panorama of the heavens appeared in the spacecraft window. Now, as I watched this, just from shortly after leaving the moon. And remember, my workload was a little lower at that point because I was responsible for the lunar spacecraft and the lunar surface activities. And those were really done, so I could be a little bit more of a tourist, although we still had work to do in a spacecraft to fly. I could be a little bit more relaxed than my partners at this point.
Right.
And was looking out the window, watching this. And I have to point out to our listeners that in space, because of the lack of intervening atmosphere, the stars are 10 times as numerous and 10 times as bright as you can possibly see on Earth without a telescope, simply because of the intervening atmosphere. And that is wow. And when I was watching this, every 2 minutes, this magnificent panorama, and that's when I realized from my studies that my molecules were created in some ancient star system.
Right.
And in some way, that made us brothers. But here, this experience was not an intellectual experience like it was in college or in school studying this. No, it was a visceral experience of falling in love with this idea. And this, I'd never had such an experience, a deep emotional experience like this. And it was only after we got back from Earth with this, to Earth with this experience happening, whenever I had a break in work and could look out the window and started trying to find out what in the world was this all about, why was it, and found nothing in the science literature and nothing in the religious literature. And I appealed to some anthropologist PhDs from a nearby university to help me find this experience. And they came in the literature, and they came back to me a few weeks later and said, we found this in the ancient Sanskrit of India, and it's 5,000 or so years old. I said, well, tell me. He said, that's experience of seeing things in their separateness and their individuality, as we do when we are looking at things, but experience them viscerally as one with self, as a unity, a oneness. And I said, well, that's exactly what it felt like. And I said, what is that called? And they said, well, in the ancient Sanskrit, that's called samadhi, or savakapa samadhi, an enlightenment experience.
Right.
And I said, well, that's exactly what it was, and it's powerful. Well, I have been able to recreate that many times here on Earth.
Really?
But more importantly, oh, yes. Particularly when I'm flying or when I'm in meditation, it's an experience that can be recreated. But more importantly, I subsequently found, as I worked through the literature and I have been in different cultures and around the world and talked to the old-timers and read the literature, that such experiences are recorded in the literature of every culture on Earth. And it, frankly, is the basis of our religion. It is from these ideas that our religions have arisen, this transcendental or transformational type experience that is recorded in all cultures. But unfortunately, the cultural expression of it in their political, economic, and social forms rapidly starts to take on the culture itself as opposed to the transcendental aspects of it. And the deep meaning of this quite often gets lost. So we end up here years later fighting over who's God, the best God, and whose experience is the best experience, when that's the antithesis of everything that experience is about.
Sure, sure.
Wow.
I want to ask just a quick sidebar. In your opinion, Dr. Mitchell, do you think everybody would be able to achieve that same type of experience if they were to practice and meditate?
Well, something close to it. I don't know that everybody... But it has been recorded in the cloistered traditions of virtually all traditions, and the answer is yes. If not exactly the most peak experience, one very close to it. In other words, it is not an unknown experience at all, and has been recorded throughout history, particularly in the cultured disciplines.
Right.
I should have used the word cloistered disciplines.
I love that. ATS member that goes by the name of Beck and a Broom says, Dr. Mitchell, at what age did you know that you were going to be or wanted to pursue being an astronaut, and what were the reasons that you chose this career?
Well, as I touched upon briefly, it occurred, I really didn't have any plans when I graduated from Carnegie Mellon in 1952. To have a military career or even a career in aviation, although I started flying for the fun of it when I was 13 years old. But I was about to be drafted into the Korean War, so I succumbed to that, went off and did my duty for my country. And it was when coming back to test pilot duty at the end of my tour of duty in the Korean War and had the experience of being there when Sputnik went up and suddenly realizing that that was a whole new possible career and excited about it. And that was the moment right then. It was that moment when Sputnik went up, that day when Sputnik went up. Now, like many of my colleagues, as it turns out, I had read Buck Rogers, the comic strip, back when I was a kid.
Sure.
That was just really fantasy at that point.
I'll never forget, as long as I live, and John, I'm sure you would agree, where I was when news hit the United States that the Russians had launched Sputnik. I'll never forget how paranoid our class got. I mean, it made me so paranoid as a kid for fear of, you know, not knowing whether we were going to get blown out of the sky or not.
Well, and that is not surprising. And you see, here many years later, after that, and the fact is, during the time of President Reagan, when we were trying to do the Star Wars initiative of put weapons in space, it really just brought that fear a step closer to reality.
Right.
One of the most dumb things we have ever done is to propose to put weapons in space, because all it does is bring us closer to that fateful day that you were hiding under the desk from when you were a kid.
Yeah.
A few more questions here from our members and listeners.
Go ahead.
UV77BK says, do you think, Dr. Mitchell, that since you've recently gone public with your thoughts about life existing elsewhere and UFOs, that perhaps other astronaut scientists, military officials may be more inclined to come forward with their stories?
That is already starting to happen, as a matter of fact. It is happening. I happen to be moving circles and know some of the things that are happening that are not generally known at the moment. And it is quite true that there are many individuals, but particularly people who have done the research and are in the know, that are quite willing now to start telling their story.
I'm sure you've never been asked this question before, but it's a question that has to be asked by member Boogley. And he says, Dr. Mitchell, was the moon everything that you dreamed it would be when you actually arrived there?
Well, the answer is yes, because we arrived with the expectation of explorers and scientists wanting to discover what really was there. And all we found was enigma after enigma and issue after issue that titillated the imagination and the desire to know more. And so, an explorer's dream. What more can an explorer want than to go where humans have never been before, take pictures, look around, get samples, and come home and tell the people. And that's what we did.
A couple of questions have been addressed by you, Dr. Mitchell, so we're going to fast forward here. So DJ Cloudy and Phoenix, sorry, those have already been covered. Well, actually, I will ask DJ Cloudy's question, which is, I have heard that some astronauts have experienced very strange effects while being in space. Here again, you've pretty much touched on some of this, but his question was, did you ever experience any hallucinations, such as geometric symbols, or other type of sensory phenomena? And if so, could you elaborate on those?
No, I have never experienced that. Well, certainly not in space. If you have a nightmare,
sorry,
too much, you might have a strange experience.
I am so sorry.
Oh, that's
Edgar.
A great answer too.
I love. Can we quote you on that, Edgar?
Well, then let me go to this member then, if I could, Dave. Let me just jump ahead since that was a no-go on that one.
Okay.
A listener and member by the name of Alfred Packer asked this. Did you ever get to travel around? Well, this is actually an obvious question, but travel around the dark side of the moon, and when orbiting it, did you experience what has been purported to be weird noise, acoustics, or humming while traveling through that dead radio silence zone on the dark side?
Well, first of all, let's correct the terminology.
Sure, it's the far side, right?
The far side is the right terminology.
Right.
It's not any more distant than the other side, but only one side of the moon faces the Earth. And so you can call it the near side or the front space. And no, never experienced the sort of strange noises that you're talking about. However, some of the command module pilots who were in orbit alone by themselves I don't know what they experienced. You would have to ask them particularly. But it's the darkest dark, the blackest black, and being totally alone on the far side of the moon, as out of touch with Earth and out of touch with your partners, it's a rather strange experience. But I won't try to interpret that for them.
Sure.
Maybe you can have on your show one of these days some of the astronauts who were command module pilots on a lunar mission and had that experience of going behind the moon and out of sight of Earth and out of sight of communications alone, and at the same time being in total darkness if that part of the moon was in shadow. And some did report some interesting experiences. I don't know what kind of what they really were, whether it's, I'm sure it was an hallucination because we're all pretty stable.
Right.
But at least some interesting experiences.
I know that you guys, that you do training in special suits underwater to kind of get used to the gravity effects. Being a scuba instructor and have explored numerous areas under our planet, or in inner space, if you will, I know what the tranquility is of only having the ocean around me, and the only thing being able to hear is the air bubbles. So, I mean, my question is, when you're in the suits and you're walking on the moon, and is it so overwhelming, I guess, Edgar, is my question, that the only thing you hear is your own breath?
Well, that and Houston talking in your ear.
Yeah.
And you can steal a few moments of looking around and taking all of that in.
Right.
But then the clock is ticking, your checklist, you're getting further behind, so it's back to work again.
Right.
So you don't have a lot of time to enjoy that. And that in some sense is a shame, because we would like to have done more, but the clock was ticking and spending millions of dollars a minute just to be there. We had to do work, and many of us took that pretty seriously.
Well, I'll go ahead and I'll jump right in here with a member by the name of Sunray06, who asked this question. Have you at any time had any discussions with any governmental department or agencies thereof regarding possible presence of UFOs on our planet? And if so, were there any conclusions that were drawn?
Oh, yes. That was one of the things I did, and I have talked about it, in which I did go to the Pentagon, and I did talk to some senior people there, and one of them in particular, a very senior person, said, "I don't know about this, but I will find out for you," and later confirmed my experience, but later, because of his own age, he could no longer talk about it, so he was very isolated. But the point is, yes, I did. I've had it confirmed. And, of course, I've talked with most of the in-the-know people where this information has slowly leaked over the years, and I have had a lot of it confirmed.
And this is by member Zephyrin. Dr. Mitchell, have you ever been involved in or a member of any group such as a think tank?
Well, quite a few of them, which depends on what you want to think about.
Well, is it one that you could maybe mention, or just so people will know that, you know, that there's these special things for the high intellect individuals like yourself and your comrades that you go and discuss things that maybe are not available in the mainstream media about hypothetics or whatever?
Well, I mean, there are quite a number of very high-powered institutions that do this sort of thing. I've worked for Stanford Research Institute, upon many occasions. I consider my Noetics Foundation one of those at a pretty high level, doing things that are not the norm or mainstream. In other words, frontier science is what I'm all about, and that means exploring where, like we explored the moon, exploring realms in science where we really don't have answers. And if you really study science, and particularly cosmology, and particularly the photographs coming back from these Hubble telescope and these ancient distant pictures, you realize, in some sense, we're just barely out of the trees. We think we're pretty smart, but we really aren't. And I like to point it out in this way. I tell this to some of my audience, particularly if there's young people involved, that my great-grandparents came across from South Georgia to West Texas after the Civil War, seeking a new life. And they went in covered wagons, pulled by horses, a few had a cattle, to start a new life. Railroads weren't complete across the South and the West. Automobiles hadn't been invented. Electric lights hadn't been invented. My father was born shortly after the Wright brothers made the first flight of an airplane. And I went to the moon. So from covered wagons to going to the moon in less than 100 years. And here we have been humans on this planet for thousands of years. And we've walked, ridden horses, elephants, camels, whatever.
Right.
And the period of the 20th century, the last half of the 19th century, and the 20th century has been the period of the greatest explosion of science and its offshoot technology and new products that the world has ever seen. So we have lived through the 20th century and into the 21st century in a terribly, very unique period, and much almost to our undoing, because we're no longer on a sustainable path. We are consuming and creating and propagating and multiplying at an unsustainable rate, so that our environment is in danger. The seas are in danger of losing edible fish. We're in real trouble, and we have to stop to think about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact,
that blows me away.
Yeah.
I'm just sorry. What you just got through saying just so.
It resonates deeply, doesn't it, Dave?
It really does for me.
But if we take it to its ultimate extreme, this will be my last statement on this. Take it to its ultimate extreme. Our star, our sun, is about halfway through its life cycle. We've only got about another couple of billion years. Now, that sounds like a long time, but it's going to burn out. And if our species is to survive, we have to be off this planet. So we have to be spacefarers as a civilization in due course.
We have a member, a listener, who is going to be doing a live question query for you, sir. And we have him on right now. He goes by the name of The Borg, but we'll call him Trent. And Trent, if you are there, I'd like you to introduce yourself to Dr. Mitchell.
Hello, Dr. Mitchell. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Trent, how are you?
I'm okay. Well,
okay, what's your question?
What are your thoughts on long-term space travel?
Well, certainly we have to develop that in due course. But also we really don't know all of the secrets of space travel. We're just getting our feet wet. We're just beginning. So there's a lot to be learned here. But as I pointed out in one of my last remark, we have to consider ourselves spacefarers and universal citizens, because we have to be off of this planet in due course. So there's a lot to learn before we can really get there. But I do like to point out that we will go to Mars in due course, and when we look back from Mars to this tiny little planet we call Earth, it'll sound kind of stupid to say we came from the United States, Canada, England, Russia, Germany, Israel, Brazil, wherever. No, we came from Earth. And we're not ready to do that. We haven't got our act together well enough to do that. But that's where we have to be if we're going to be a spacefaring civilization.
All right, go ahead and ask him your second question, Trent.
Okay. What are your thoughts on, for example, to get from here to Mars on using a solar sail to ride the solar wind, which is traveling at about 1,000,000 miles an hour?
Well, there's a lot of work had been done in solar sailing. Now, we haven't developed any spacecraft to really test that yet. But I did some work on that in my doctoral thesis back 40 years ago when we were talking about interplanetary navigation. But all of these types of propulsion systems and how to live and work in space, how to live longer, how to grow food on spacecraft, that's what the International Space Station and long-term spaceflight will be all about. And it's just in its infancy at this point.
We want to especially thank you, Trent, for coming forward and asking your question live. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Mitchell, for the opportunity. It's been a life's dream to be able to do this.
You bet. glad to be here.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Dr. Mitchell, since you kind of covered on that, and since Trent or the Borg asked the question about the solar sail, is there possibly another avenue for us getting from point A to point B, maybe even if it's out-of-the-box type thinking, that you think might be viable for us to investigate?
Oh, yes, Rex. Sorry, being investigating. It's a part of trying to understand the so-called ET or UFO propulsion systems. Now, I am not knowledgeable in it particularly. I've just been on the edge of it a little bit and talked to people who are more knowledgeable than I. But some of the long-distance things that we would have to encounter here, they have been solved. And the propulsion systems, anti-gravitational systems, I can't say that we know a lot about them, but some people do. They've been working on this for a long time. And I'm not up to speed on the technologies or the science there, but before we do these long-term flights and before we ourselves become ETs to some planet, we have to learn these things. And that's right around the corner, I think, in the next century, provided we don't blow ourselves up with our stupidities in the process.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Edgar. I really am, because there's a lot of stupidity out there. Well, as we're kind of winding down to our allocated time with Edgar, I mean, I've got to ask you, you know, what's the future hold for you, and what's your plans on what you are trying to achieve in the next, maybe the next year, let's say?
Well, I am with my research foundation, my Quantrek Foundation, and Noetics Foundation, trying to help us move toward a position of sustainability in our civilization. And my particular desire for that is the frontier of science, and to learn more about the deepest frontier science that we still seem very mysterious to us. And it has to do with areas called quantum holography and areas of why are we conscious and how does consciousness really function in nature? Where did it come from? I just have to say that we think we're pretty smart, but we have just barely scratched the surface on understanding this universe that we're in. And there's a lot to be learned. And if we're going to be a sustainable civilization, we have to start learning it a lot faster than we are right now. And that's what I do.
I have one quick question here before we sign off with you, sir. Your book, Psychic Exploration and the Way of the Explorer, would you by chance be working on another book?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am. I have just published a monograph, or it's just in a publication process, on quantum holography, which is a breakthrough sort of discovery that one of my colleagues made a few years ago, and I've been applying it to the studies of consciousness, and I think I've been urged at this point to write a book on the UFO area, and we're considering how to put that one together. And so, yes, there's a lot to write about, and I probably will have another one out here in the next couple of years.
Oh, that's awesome. I can't wait.
Well,
my mouth is watering now.
Yeah, I'm chomping at the bits, and especially people can find out everything that they want to know from an insider standpoint by going to the www.edmitchellapollo14.com website, and you'll be able to see everything that Ed has put together for all the fans of the Apollo program, as well as NASA, and just Edgar's own personal viewpoints about some things. Just really a marvelous site. And then the other I want to is the Noetic Sciences site. Just really has blown me away. I spent a day or two, Edgar, on this, and it just has some amazing things on it. And I want to remind everybody that you can go to that by www.noetic.org. That's Noetic.org. And then finally, for all you scientists out there, which I am not one, I even was able to understand a lot of the things that Edgar has on his site, www.quantrek.org. And there's just some really terrific things there. And Edgar, I got to tell you, as one military man to another, although you can't see it, I'm giving you a big, huge salute from those of us that have always admired you as an individual, not only for your service to our country, but for being a man with the right stuff and being the sixth man to walk on the moon. And we can't thank you enough for your time with us today, sir.
Well, you guys are just great and one of the best interviews I've enjoyed doing. It's been a privilege to be with you, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, oh, really, boy, and we didn't even have to pay him to say that.
I love that, Edgar. So until next time, I'm Dave Rabbit.
And I'm Johnny Anonymous. Thanks for joining us for the ATS Mix.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.